I'm in Starbucks. I've ordered my drink. They asked me my name, Hugh. I sort of shuffle along the counter. I pick up the drink, and I'm always intrigued to see how my name has been spelt. There seem to be a lot of options. H-U-W is quite popular. A lot of the Korean staff must have been in Wales. Then, you know, I've got H-U-Q-Z-U-K-Y-U. I realised after, because they're not actually asking for my name so they can get to know me. They just want a label so drink and owner can be united at the end of the counter. I've paid the money, they've promised the drink, we need to get together. So when they asked for my name, I thought, well, time for a change. I said, Tony. And as I waited in the queue, I got into an animated conversation with a friend, and I got to the far end, and I realised after a bit that three or four people behind me in the queue had picked up their drinks and gone, and I said, where's mine? And the staff consulted together, and they pointed to the mug, and there it was with Tony on it. They called out Tony three or four times. I just hadn't registered what was going... I won't be trying that again. I won't be trying that again. But the Starbucks principle works in other fast food shops, doesn't it? You know, your drink is promised, your cup is kept for you, your name literally on it, and you get to the end of the counter and you pick it up. Meanwhile, it's yours, but it's a not-yet drink. And it's like that with the Bible. See, people of promise are pilgrim people. We live for a not-yet world. God's promise is like that cup. It's got our name on it, but you still have to shuffle to the end of the counter to pick it up and enjoy it to the full. Don't settle down and stop before you reach the end of the counter. That's the lesson from that portrait gallery in Hebrews 11. You know, name after name after name is mentioned. Have you seen those walls in clubs or sports pavilions where they've got endless photos of previous teams and club captains or presidents, you know, going all the way back to the sepia-tinted ones? Well, here it's the great heroes of faith. And Abraham is in the thick of them, and they live for a not-yet world. Remember, this is what the writer said of them. All these people... and Abraham is included. All these people were still living by faith when they died. They didn't receive the things promised. They only saw them and welcomed them from a distance, admitting that they were foreigners and strangers on earth. Foreigners and strangers. People of promise are pilgrim people. We live for a not yet world. We're foreigners and strangers in this world. And we saw last week that Abraham was a model of that faith, the beginning of the family tree, the line of the promised people. And he's on a great journey with great promises to keep him going. A land to enjoy. A nation to father. All peoples on earth to bring a blessing to. And Abraham's battle and ours will be living true to those promises through the not yet. Model of faith he may be, but Abraham is no one-dimensional character. You know, it's like some films, a character gets introduced early on, and in the opening shots, it looks like just a totally straightforward hero figure. And it's only as the film develops and goes behind the scenes, you discover the character becomes much more complex. Well, we'll see that with Abraham. For him, as for us, the call to be a disciple, the call to start his journey, doesn't make him perfect. Disciples can still live like losers and find that God still holds on to us. And this afternoon, we're going to watch Abraham handle two very different incidents. I've called the first one this, when God's promise is not enough. Now, one of the frustrations of reading Old Testament narrative, Old Testament stories, is what it does not say. How it can describe events, report them factually, and not tell you whether people were morally right or wrong to do what they did in them. And you've got to wrestle and decide whether there are principles elsewhere you're meant to apply to this situation, or whether the author is leaving it because he is focused elsewhere. It's like that here. Look down at chapter 12 and verse 10. Now, there was a famine in the land that was promised to Abraham. There was a famine in the land, and Abraham went down to Egypt to live there for a while because the famine was severe. Was that a wise, prudent move or a faithless one? Yeah? Should Abraham have stuck it out and trusted God to provide? Or was this just a wise initiative on his part? Our author doesn't seem interested in that. He's actually got a far more substantial bone to pick with Abraham and how he treats this people promise from God, the assurance that he'll be the father of a great nation. Look at verse 11. See, as he was about to enter Egypt, he said to his wife Sarah, "I know what a beautiful woman you are." By the way, those are the first recorded words that Abraham says in the Bible. I mean, if you think about it, they sound healthy wisdom for any marriage relationship, don't they? At least they would do if it wasn't for what followed. Yeah, I know what a beautiful woman you are. And when the Egyptians see you, they'll say, "This is his wife," and then they'll kill me but let you live. So say you're my sister so that I'll be treated well for your sake and my life will be spared because of you. There is a half-truth buried in there. Sarah was some kind of stepsister to Abraham, but actually it's the deceit, not the truth, that's the focus. See, at its worst, this is Abraham lying to save his own skin. And never mind what happens to Sarah. At its best, he's remembered God's people promise. He knows that his survival is essential if he's to father a great nation. But so actually is Sarah's. And we'll need to be at our most charitable and assume Abraham thinks as brother he might be able to deter and hold off any admirers. The Me Too generation is thousands of years ahead, but the reason for it, exploitative men, is nothing new, dates back at least as far as Abraham. See, Abraham may be deceitful, but he's not a fool. Sarah's beauty isn't just a question of his rose-tinted spectacles. He may be 75, Sarah in her 60s, but she has the looks to catch the eye of the Egyptian officials, the Egyptian recruiters, and Pharaoh. See verse 15 at the end? She was taken into his palace, and not for a National Trust tour, as part of his harem. And Sarah's treated as a commodity. Abraham is well paid for her. It still tragically happens today, doesn't it? It's just that these days the price is not usually sheep, cattle, donkeys, servants, and camels. Whatever place God's promise had in Abraham's thinking, he reckoned without Pharaoh taking a shine to Sarah, taking her into his harem, overpowering any influence Abraham might have as brother or whatever, any influence he might have on what happens next. Whatever place God's promise had in Abraham's thinking, it wasn't enough for him. He didn't leave any room for God to deliver on the promise. It's his own ingenuity he's relying on, his scheming, and it's just got him in a mess that's beyond his control. When God's promise is not enough, on this occasion, God steps in to show it is, and he can be trusted. And in verse 17, for the first time in the whole incident, the Lord appears. Verse 17, but the Lord inflicted serious diseases on Pharaoh and his household because of Abraham's wife, Sarah. Now, how did Pharaoh get from diseases breaking out to Sarah as the problem? How did he discover she was actually Abraham's wife? Had he already slept with her? I'm asking all those kind of questions, but our author isn't interested. He's making one point loud and clear. The Lord is able to keep his promise. He steps in, and even Pharaoh steps into line with his plans. See, in fact, far from acting like a tyrant, Pharaoh acts like someone who fears God. He doesn't want the guilt of taking someone else's wife on his hands. So Abraham's visa is revoked. He's deported, escorted out of the country. You notice verse 20, with his wife and everything he had. So Abraham blunders into Egypt with his own deceitful scheming as his own his only defense. He re-emerges very wealthy, we discover, verse 2 of chapter 13, but very humbled and shown how God can keep his promises even with the most undeserving of followers. And Abraham returns to where he started out, to the place between Bethel and Ai, where his tent had been earlier and where he'd first built an altar. Altars matter to Abraham. Altars are where atonement's made by the offering of a sacrifice. Abraham goes back and starts all over again, so to speak. Back in the early years of the last century, there were a handful of revivals in East Anglia. They're not spoken about much because they didn't really seem to have any lasting effect. But for a few brief years, they were significant in those places. One of the primary preachers and leaders at the time was a man called Douglas Brown, and he once helpfully described what revival was. He said, "Revival is not going down the street with a big drum. It's going back to Calvary with a big sob." It's what some of us will need to do this evening, because we'll have acted as if God's promise is not enough. We'll have lived trusting our own scheming and lived our lives by that rather than God's ways and God's keeping power. And some of us know what it is to land up a loser and to have devastated our lives and others as a result. And Calvary, the cross of Jesus, where he was sacrificed, is where God keeps hold of losers and keeps us for his not yet world. When God's promise is not enough. But there's another different incident here. I've called this one, "When God's promise is all you need." And the threat here is less to the people promise that Abraham will be the father of a great nation, more to the place promise that God has a land for him to enjoy. Abraham and Lot, you see, have left Egypt wealthier than they went in. And they discover they actually just have too much stuff. Too much stuff to be able to live together. Look at verse 6 of chapter 13. "But the Lord, the land could not support them while they stayed together, for their possessions were so great that they were not able to stay together. There were too many herds and flocks and too little pasture." Verse 7. "Quarreling arose between Abraham's herders and Lot's, and the Canaanites and the Perizzites were also living in the land at that time." They've got to cope as well. You know, it doesn't need much insight to see it would only take one small spark for it all to flare up into tragedy. So they separate in verses 8 and 9. Abraham's the elder. He's the senior. He's Lot's uncle. But he gives Lot first pick. So verse 10, "Lot looked around and saw." Now, poor Lot gets a pretty terrible press, but it's hard to read Genesis and not think he just fell for Sodom's immoralities and indulged. Even at this early stage, writers deliver their psychological dissections on him. So it is worth remembering that when the New Testament passes its verdict on Lot in Sodom, it called him a righteous man. That righteous man. It spoke of his righteous soul. You find all of those in 2 Peter chapter 2. What he's not included in is the Hebrews 11 heroes of faith. He's not mentioned alongside Abraham as one who lived as a foreigner and stranger and lived for a not yet world. So as Lot looks, it seems less likely that he licked his lips at the thought of enjoying the bright lights of Sodom, more likely that he just missed the danger signs. See, verse 10. "Lot looked around and he saw that the whole plain of the Jordan towards Zoar was well watered, like the garden of the Lord, like the land of Egypt." Remember, this man is a famine survivor. And he looks and he sees it's ideal for grazing. It's good for crops. He saw the comforts. He smelt the money, so to speak. He missed the danger. See how verse 10 ends? This was before the Lord destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah. Lot goes, and we're told at the end of verse 12, he pitched his tents near Sodom, and the writer adds, as if Lot should have seen it too, now the people of Sodom were wicked and were sinning greatly against the Lord. Now, red warning lights should have been flashing all over Lot's brain, but he was blind to them. It's reminded me this week, as I've been thinking about it, to pray that familiar phrase from the Lord's Prayer, lead us not into temptation, with new meaning. I think I kind of lazily always think of some overwhelming temptation that would just leave me out of my spiritual depth. But I've been praying as well now for those temptations that stitch me up and take me captive because I just miss them. I don't even spot the danger. You know, we live so comfortably here. Pretty much all of us, across the board. We don't notice, really. There may not always be choices consciously made with this motive, but so often our decisions about life and careers and home and churches are made for here, for settling as if here is home, rather than that we are foreigners and strangers on earth. God's people in God's promised land. It's a great theme of the Old Testament. They're always searching for it, fighting for it, exiled from it, returning to it, without it ever quite living up to the promises. And that promised land continues to shape Middle Eastern politics, boundaries and borders today. In fact, you can't understand many of the tensions and conflicts without taking all of that into account. But however you view the land, and Christians I know have several different viewpoints, it's hard to deny, though, that the New Testament puts the focus on a future promised land for God's people. On Jerusalem, yes, but the Jerusalem that's above. On a promised land, certainly, but it's the new heaven and the new earth where our hopes are to be planted. Until then, we live as foreigners and strangers, living for a not yet world. But it's hard to have our wealth and our opportunities and to keep living as a pilgrim people. Abraham faces those battles and tensions, but for the moment at least, for him, God's promise is all he needs. It gives him the freedom to let go, to leave Lot, to make the first choice, knowing that he, Abraham, won't be missing out. His security, his identity, his future, they're not at risk. There are some riches we're going to need to learn to look at and remind ourselves, you know, whether it's salary or home or car or gizmo, we're going to need to learn to say, they won't last. They won't last. That they can't bear the weight of our all-consuming passion. They won't even satisfy our idly drifting after them the way everyone else does. Now, our distinctive is to live for a not-yet world. And Abraham's content to live as foreigner and stranger. And God repeats his promises to him and enlarges them. Look at verse 15. All the land that you see, Abraham, and you can look north, south, east, west, I will give not just as he promised previously to your offspring, but to you and your offspring forever. And I'll make your offspring not just a great nation, as he originally promised, but I'll make your offspring like the dust of the earth, so that if anyone could count the dust, then your offspring could be counted. Hey, God's promise is all you need. And as if that's not confidence enough, God says, verse 17, go, walk through the length and breadth of the land, for I'm giving it to you. He's not going to live there. He's not going to occupy it. He's not got the title deeds in his name yet. But it's as if God, it's as if Abraham is being given a taster of what's to come. You know, the fact that we live for a not yet world doesn't mean that God gives us no encouragements, no indicators of that future, that ultimate reality. Jesus' own ministry was riddled with them, tasters of where the future would take us. So the chapter ends in verse 18 with Abraham doing what he'd done before. He built an altar to the Lord, a place of sacrifice. Abraham worshipped by sacrifice, by God's great grace. And that memorial meal, which Jesus instituted as a reminder of his great sacrificial death, that meal which we celebrate tonight, it looks back to Calvary, certainly. But it also looks ahead to where the story is going to end. It looks ahead to a wedding banquet where God's people are united with Jesus, their Lord and Savior. Where God's people, drawn from all nations on earth, sitting down to the feast at home with God. No longer foreigners and strangers, but residents and citizens in the world that really matters. See, tonight, we eat and drink to that future as a taster for when the not yet becomes our home. So next time you find yourself in Starbucks or its equivalent, and you're shuffling along the counter to pick up your not yet drink with your name on it, remember God's promises with your name correctly spelt on them. And remind yourself and the friend you're with to make sure you keep going, even if you do feel like a stranger and a foreigner. Well, that long journey is the basis of the song we're going to sing as we close now. It's one of those songs with new words and a familiar tune. It speaks of Abraham's long journey and the God who makes us his own by promise and gives us himself by grace. Let's stand to sing.